CLS is the weighing machine was created to help you, the financial advisor or investor, reach your long-term financial goals. Each episode, your hosts, Rusty Vanneman and I, Robin Murray, cut through the market clamor to find the time-tested principles that help investors succeed.
CLS is the weighing machine is inspired by two ideas. The first is the classic investing truism attributed to Benjamin Graham, that the stock market is a voting machine in the short run and a weighing machine in the long run. In other words, emotion drives short-term market movement, but fundamentals and valuations drive returns over time. The second idea is CLS's investment methodology of risk budgeting. Represented by the scales, risk budgeting measures and manages risk to suit the needs of each investor.
Welcome to CLS's The Weighing Machine.
We hope you enjoy it. And as always, please let us know what you think.
On the podcast today, we'll look back at the year and decade that was and what's in store for the roaring 20s, including the megatrends set to shape the decade.
We will also discuss the best performing stocks of 2019, risk budgeting in the U.S. and global markets, and how to close the behavior gap. That's all with our guest, CLS Client Portfolio Manager, Case Eichenberger. Welcome to CLS's The Weighing Machine. I'm Rusty Vanneman.
And I'm Robin Murray. Okay, well, it is a new year and a new decade. Let's start with a look back at the markets. How did the teens turn out?
Oh, so much to talk about here. I mean, it's just like open it up for like the whole decade and the year, the quarter, the month, and everything. Well, obviously, first of all, just to refer people to the monthly commentary, which again is on clsinvest.com, we do have the performance table. And quite frankly, there's a lot to look at there. And it really was an exceptional year and an exceptional decade. And just a couple notes I want to make. I mean, last year was really a great year. It was, I think, the best year for global stock markets since 2009, the best year for the U.S. market since 2013, almost the best year in 20 years, but didn't quite make it. The best year for balanced portfolios in a couple decades. It was really a great year for investors. I think it's kind of interesting to see what didn't do as well, because I think it's sort of interesting. I mean, first of all, the first thing, I mean, it was a double-digit return for most growth-oriented asset classes. And in fact, 30% returns were pretty common. But cash, so if you were just kept your money in the bank because you're trying to play it safe, you earned a whopping 2% last year. So that was clearly a laggard. Other laggards included the bond market, though really the bond market had a phenomenal year. Bonds were up in aggregate almost 10%. So I think that's really interesting. And another asset class that might be surprising is one that's really been a laggard of late, or commodities. It also just finished with returns just below 10%. If you look at the 10-year numbers, similar stories here. Again, double-digit returns for the stock market, really phenomenal. Cash was less than 1%. So a lot of people have been on the sidelines for most of the teens. Commodities were actually negative, which is pretty exceptional for any asset class. And so a lot of things jump out. And again, people should check out the performance table on the commentary.
Well, let's continue with some predictions for 2020 and beyond, market predictions and some others. Starting with stocks, what's our price outlook, earnings outlook, and expectations for attractive areas?
A lot of things here. So first of all, when it comes to the stock market, I guess the CLS outlook is not too contrarian from what the rest of the industry is saying, and that is expect positive returns, probably single digits, definitely not as strong as this year. It's easy to say returns won't be as strong as this year, given how strong it was. But I think a couple of things do stand out. I mean, first of all, even though people seem to be pretty optimistic coming into this year, a lot of people have concerns like, can we possibly have a great year after we've just had a great year? Can we possibly have a great year because of the upcoming election? Can we possibly have a great year because valuations are so high? And all these various concerns. And the answer is, when you look at the historical market precedents, yes, most likely we still are going to have positive returns despite all those variables. So that's one thing. The other thing, probably the smart way to probably think about this year, what will probably happen, which means it probably won't, is that you have the election coming up in the latter half of the year, and that uncertainty is probably going to increase the volatility. And so probably you're going to get better returns in the first half of the year than the next. But again, that's short-term forecasting. In terms of earnings are interesting. Earnings this year weren't great. I mean, the market's up 30%. Earnings growth was not strong in the U.S., but it is starting to recover, and expectations right now is that earnings growth will be above average within a few quarters, so that should be a plus for the market. As for attractive areas within the stock market, it's kind of the same what we've been talking about. For long-term investors, you have to go to areas where the relative valuations just look a lot more attractive compared to the U.S. That includes international stocks. It includes value-oriented sectors such as financials. There's an argument for real assets such as commodities. So there's some attractive areas in the markets.
What about the bond market? What are we expecting there?
Well, the bond market, of course, as we always say, still makes sense for investors because it helps control portfolio risk. It obviously is a hedge versus corrections within the stock market, so it still makes sense. But the return potential is just not that exciting. I mean, interest rates are really low. We do expect interest rates to rise slightly higher, which means that returns will be compromised a little bit if that is in fact the case. And the other thing about the bond market is that usually there's a lot of different parts of the bond market. So it just isn't the interest rate number they quote in the press. There's a lot of different segments, and you can actively manage to add value. But that said, just about every part of the bond markets have been picked over. Some of them are like the most expensive they've been in like 25 years or nearly so. There's only a couple areas which seem reasonably attractive, like emerging market debt is like along long-term averages. Municipal bonds are near long-term averages, but really everything's been picked over.
How about the general economy, GDP, monetary, fiscal policy?
Okay, so on some of these things, GDP growth, in terms of what the CLS investment team thinks, is, again, it's not too contrarian. We're looking for positive growth, but below average growth relative to long-term averages, so 2% plus instead of 3% plus. Though we do kind of think there will be a little bit of lift going into the year, just like what we're expecting with earnings growth. As for monetary and fiscal policy, probably the best bet at this point is that monetary policy, of course, is kind of spent. I mean, you're probably not going to see the Federal Reserve change interest rates. They've already done about all they can do with monetary policy. So the expectation is they will probably see more fiscal policy. And that makes sense because we have an election coming up. So everybody's going to be promising stuff. In terms of inflation, you didn't ask about that, but a very important criteria is that inflation, we do expect to kind of crawl ever so higher. Obviously, it's still something to be concerned about, particularly, given the monetary and fiscal policy backdrops and given the fact the economy is at full capacity in some areas, something we haven't seen. So inflation still looks like it could come around. Of course, I've been saying that for a while. Next is the dollar. And the dollar is really interesting because the dollar has been getting weaker here in recent weeks. And that has caused a rotation within the markets. International has been handling outperforming domestic markets. Value has been outperforming growth stocks. Real assets, again, like commodities are performing well. Again, some sectors such as natural resources and energy stocks are starting to do well. Would expect the dollar still to weaken. And to me, one of the big backdrops for the dollar is something called purchasing power parity. It has shown the dollar to be expensive for a while. So obviously, that's not a good short-term predictor. But probably a better is just looking at the technicals of the market, which means looking at the price action. And in that case, the dollar had been strong for so long. But if you look at the charts now, it is clearly broken down and would suggest more weakness for the dollar moving forward. And that's a big deal. That would definitely benefit CLS portfolios.
There are also likely to be big changes in the industry for financial advisors. What are we watching for there?
Well, a couple things. One thing we've talked about a lot, and that is a concept called direct indexing. And direct indexing is, again, the concept. Instead of buying like the S&P index fund, you would buy something that would be a portfolio which would be direct indexed to the S&P. In other words, instead of owning just a single ticker, you would own a combination of securities which basically replicates the return of the S&P 500. Now, why would you do this? Really, the reason why you do this is that, particularly for a taxable investor, you can actively manage it in terms of harvesting tax losses, controlling whether you have long-term or short-term gains. There's a lot of things you can do, and that's called tax alpha, and you can create 1% to 2% of tax alpha. It's sort of that kind of that general rule of thumb. It kind of really depends on the portfolio. And so that is a really big deal, and particularly so not only because technology has really caught up, because direct indexing has been around for decades, but the technology is so much more advanced now that you can bring direct indexing to the smaller to lower minimum accounts, but because fractional share trading has now become more common, the fact that transaction costs or commissions have been reduced, direct indexing is going to become a really big deal. The second thing is, which was really big news here towards the tail end of the year, is something called the SECURE Act. And the SECURE Act is, it stands for, I'm actually reading this here because I can't remember it. Setting every community up for a Retirement Enhancement Act. Huh. So it's pretty clever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of a big deal. I mean, some of the easy things about the SECURE Act include the required minimum distributions. The RMDs have been increased to 72. It has been 70.5 years old. The age cap for IRA contributions has been removed. So that's kind of a big deal as well because it was capped at 70 and a half years old again. And another thing which could be fairly disruptive is that inherited retirement accounts must be fully distributed within 10 years of the inheritance. Now, there's a lot of exceptions to this one. I think they're pretty big exceptions, such as spouses and inheritors that are no more than 10 years younger and inheritors with disabilities or minor children. So I think there's probably been a lot of scary headlines about that, but it's probably not as dramatic as people say. And there's some other stuff that's going on. So I would basically expect that listeners to the podcast will hear more about this in future podcasts, and you'll also see more about it in our commentaries.
All right. Well, we'll keep listening. 2020 is also guaranteed to be a big news year. As you've mentioned, we have a presidential election coming up. First, let's place some bets. Who is winning the Democratic nomination and who is winning the presidency?
Great. Well, you know what? There is a website, which I love to look at. And basically, because it's like real money being bet on. It's not infallible. It's obviously been wrong a lot. But quite frankly, the track record is still better than most polls. And that is called predictit.org. And basically, if you look at that, you can kind of see where kind of the smart money is. But this stuff can change so much. So for instance, right now, who's going to win the Democratic nomination? It does look like Biden right now. Who's going to win the presidency? It does look like Trump right now. But all of this can change. But the important thing for investors really is that what can you expect due to the election? And again, volatility should definitely increase the marketplace, particularly if there's any doubt about who's going to win the election, because the markets hate uncertainty. But really, in the grand scheme of things, just don't let your political biases influence your investment decisions. We've seen this so many times. Think how many people bailed on the markets when Trump was elected because they didn't like Trump. They've definitely hurt their portfolios. But you know what? It's just like when everybody who bailed on Obama, and look how strong the market was under the Obama administration. So two dramatically different administrations, but the market did great in both environments.
Well, finally, our last prediction, and maybe the most important one, who's going to win the Super Bowl?
Wow, fun question. All right, that's awesome. All right, so I do need to rely on someone like this, just because it's only fair, is CLS Chief Investment Officer Mark Pfeffer, who did win the fantasy football competition among the research team here. I came in second, by the way, out of 14 people. That definitely gave me an opportunity to brag about that. Mark thinks, and again, he has a very strong opinion on this, that it's going to be in the AFC, and even though he's a Patriots fan, he thinks it's probably going to be either the Ravens or the Chiefs. He says that, and even though Tom Brady, he probably has posters of Tom Brady all over his office, he does think that the era of the slower, more cerebral quarterbacks is probably over, and it's going to be more athletic quarterbacks. All that said, how can you root against Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints? So that's where I'm betting.
You can't. That's the answer.
So you answered who's going to win the Super Bowl. I gave you three different answers.
Hedge it.
That's right.
Well, let's bring in our guest now. You've been hearing here CLS Client Portfolio Manager Case Eichenberger. Case, welcome
Hello.
To CLS is the
Hello.
Way.
Hello. Good to be here.
So in your weekly three out last week, you wrote about the stock market's strong performance in 2019, as we've talked about, and the year's best performing stocks. There were several outperformers, but I'm guessing your message was not about picking winners
right.
and rolling the dice.
These are always fun to look back at. I think this one was, I guess, more fun for me to look at. You know, now's the time of year where we're starting to look at outlooks for the next decade, but also reviews of the last decade, and also just 2019, which I looked at was 2019. And typically what I find is that everybody's always talking about the U.S. market, which sectors did good, which stocks did good, which I looked at. But I wanted to obviously look at global investing because we always talk about that a lot. But first and foremost, so 30% up, 31.5% up for the S&P. Let's just look at that. That happens a lot, actually, just as I note in the commentary, is up over one-third of the time when it's the market is up over 20% one-third of the time. So just as Resi said, not that infrequent, and you should always look at kind of your base rates when looking at predictions. But going from there, looking at the stocks, you know, in the U.S., there were some ones that we all know, Target, Advanced Micro Devices has been very popular. These stocks were up 100% and 150% respectively. But again, looking overseas, it's very easy to access other stocks. It's very easy to invest. It's very cost effective right now via ETFs. And we found, when I looked at this via Bloomberg research, that there were some stocks that were up over 400% in just developed international. That's ex-US, of course, and also ex-emerging markets. Arrowhead Pharmaceuticals, amongst many others, were up over 400%. And there was over 42 stocks in developed international that outpaced the top winner in the S&P 500. So more importantly, emerging market stocks had a similar story. I think just picking one out here, Piraeus Bank, Greek stock, up 250%. You really have to expand your opportunity set a lot out there. The more we do that, the more diversified we get and the better chance we have to find those up-and-coming winners. Many people probably don't recognize, but there is a lot of countries that outpaced the United States this year. 12 of them, in fact. Greece was one of them, up close to 50%. So we looked at that. I think that's kind of interesting to look at, just to kind of always look to see what's on the other side of the pond, if you will. And, you know, if we look at the decades by decade, we have this in one of our charts, one of our reference guides, is 1999 to 2009 was definitely the decade to be invested overseas. 2009 to 2019, was definitely the decade to be invested here in the U.S. Now, again, these don't run on 10-year cycles. I realize that. But nonetheless, I think we would all say that there's better chances for overseas returns to go forward.
Well, we often recommend that investors look overseas for investment opportunities, but the U.S. is generally seen as a safer bet, less risky than international markets. Is that actually true, though?
Yeah, well, depends, as we always say here. I think as we look at it right now, it is basically an even race, if you will, as far as risk-wise. Over the long term, it'll depend, of course. But right now, as we look at it, the U.S. stock market, the way we judge risk based on risk budgeting, is a risk budget score of 106, meaning by itself, it's a little bit more volatile and risky than the overall global market. You add in there also one other asset class, which a lot of people have been really down on recently, is emerging market stocks. But when we judge that ETF that tracks that index by risk, it's also 106. So a lot of people are kind of wondering, you know, one, how can that be true? Two, you know, how do you get to an overall market risk of 100, which is how we look at the global stock market. So you get to an overall stock market risk of 100 by combining those two markets plus developed international markets, and you get correlation benefits there. But I think more importantly is when people look back at those markets and just say, wow, I mean, there's no way emerging market stocks should be way riskier. There's so many more risks over there, geopolitical, currency, U.S. stocks beat emerging market stocks this year by 13%. How is it possible they're the same risk budget? Well, let's just look back not too long ago, 1 year ago, right, when we were in close to this time, Christmas Eve, kind of in free fall for the markets, down about 20% for the U.S. stock market. But emerging market stocks, developed international stocks were down, of course, as they are somewhat correlated, but they weren't down as much. So when we look at risk budget scores, and when we determine the riskiness of an asset class, we look at shorter-term timeframes, like 1 and 3 years. We also look at longer-term timeframes, like 5 and 10 years. And what we see is shorter-term timeframes, emerging market stocks have actually had better risk characteristics, lower risk characteristics via beta and standard deviation. But if you look at longer-term time periods, they are more risky, emerging market stocks are. Add them all up, though, you get about the same. And that's really how we view them right now. But we don't just view them same as risk. We also look at expected returns. And as Rusty mentioned earlier, that's based on a lot of valuations out there. And that is where you want to spend your risk budget points, on the higher expected return asset class. And that is emerging market stocks right now. So we believe that investing at least a portion of the portfolio, or maybe an emphasis towards those stocks, will help investors get their best chance for the long-term goals.
Well, part of our purpose, which is helping investors reach their long-term goals, involves minimizing the behavior gap. So that's the term for the difference in returns between what the stock market generates and what investors actually achieve. It's caused by a tendency to chase strong performance and get scared away from weak performance, just as the tide is about to turn, usually. So Gio Zelaya, who's also a client portfolio manager here at CLS, contributed this section to your weekly three. What was his message?
This one was really good. I mean, we love talking about this stuff. It's so fascinating when you bring in behavioral finance to traditional finance and economics, and that's kind of what the behavior gap is. But he looked at it a different way. And again, the behavior gap is the difference between what the investor returns compared to what the investment or stock market returns in this case. But the pain gap is probably what actually drives that difference, because the pain gap is the difference between what a given market returned for the year and also basically the high versus the low return for that year. So how high did it shoot up during the year, but also how low did it fall down during the year? For example, 1998, the S&P was up 28%, one of the biggest gains of all time, not counting this year, of course, we were up more than that, but also saw extreme volatility, 20% surge in July, followed by a collapse in October, one of the best quarters in history to end the year. So you saw a lot of volatility there. That is a roller coaster ride. That is the pain gap. Basically, as I see it, and I think as Gio would see it, the bigger the pain gap, the bigger the spread between high and low, the bigger the chance you have for investors to make a mistake, right? They make a mistake, they chase returns, they go to cash, they don't have sound financial advice, or really could use that. And that's what creates the behavior gap. So Gio then talked a lot about recent studies from Dalbar and also from Morningstar, and just really try to quantify that, if you will. And it is always there. You can quantify it, it's a little tough, but we can always know that there is a behavior gap. Really, he found that Australian investors had the best really returns for the gap there. European investors had the worst. U.S. investors, the gap had shrunk for the past 10 years. So that is good. Maybe clients are getting a little better behaved, or maybe it's just because we've been in a 10-year bull market. It's hard to tell over time. But one thing is for certain, the behavior gap is always there, and it typically widens the more volatility you have, and also how high maybe the cost of the fund you may be investing in.
A couple quick comments on that. Yeah. I mean, as Kate said, we love to talk about this stuff, and it is arguably one of our most important jobs is to kind of close that behavior gap. On one hand, I can totally get why the behavior gap has lessened in recent years, and I think, obviously, Case mentioned because the market's been up, volatility is down, but I also think there's been a big movement away from sort of transaction-based advice, which creates a sense of urgency, to fee-based advice, which calms people down. So that's a really cool thing. The other thing is, though, gosh, this stuff isn't going away. We just see it over and over and over how people chase performance. I mean, just think of this year, people hated bonds until interest rates dropped, and all of a sudden they love bonds, you know? Or it was just several months ago, coming in this fourth quarter, that investor sentiment on the stock market was about the lowest it had been in so long. It depends on what survey you're looking at. It was incredibly bearish. And then by the end of the quarter, people got bullish after we just had this great run. I mean, people are still going to chase performance. It's just human nature.
Right. Absolutely.
But it's not as bad as it was. And I think it's partly because of fee-based advisors.
Yep.
That's good news. Well, let's shift gears. Rusty, you wrote about the mega trends that we should be watching as markets shift around the world and technology accelerates change over the coming decade. These come from BlackRock, which identified 5 mega trends to shape the next 10 years. So let's run through each of them. First, technological breakthroughs.
Okay, before we run the 5 megatrends, there's 5 reasons why I like megatrends in general.
Okay.
I know. Well, so first of all, they're just kind of really intuitive stories. I think people can grab onto them. So I think that will create interest. The second thing is that I think because of the story is that we've seen really good growth rates in these sort of thematic ETFs that are based around themes. Obviously, performance has been attractive. That's a third reason. The fourth reason, which I think probably surprises people, is that these thematic ETFs have lower correlations to the overall market than most conventional ETFs, which means they kind of zig when the market's zagging. So you actually get diversification benefits depending how you use them in portfolios. And then the last thing is that a lot of these investment themes are not easy to invest in if you're investing through traditional investment vehicles. So to kind of really kind of target it, you really kind of need to use these thematic ETFs. So those are all 5 good reasons.
All right.
So you mentioned technological breakthroughs. Well, that's pretty easy because, I mean, there's a lot of different areas that I think a lot of people are seeing start to impact their lives, whether it's artificial intelligence, robotics, cybersecurity. Those are all just some examples.
Mm-hmm. What about changing demographics?
Well, changing demographics really means that the working age populations in developed markets are shrinking, and more people are kind of moving from, they're just moving into retirement. So they're just different needs and things that they want. Technology is enabling people to live longer. So again, just kind of like that consumption basket is changing considerably within the U.S. and really within the world.
Rapid urbanization.
Yep. So cities are growing fast. And according to the United Nations, 2/3 of global population will live in cities in 30 years, which means that we need infrastructure all over the world, particularly, of course, here in the U.S. Infrastructure needs are estimated to be at $100 trillion. So that is definitely an investable theme. Hey, I'm from a small town. And so when I go back to my, and so is Case. And so when we go back to our towns, I mean, it's, you would think that with technology, people could work remotely. Still not really helping the small towns. It might be helping the college towns, which are smaller cities, but it's not definitely helping our smaller towns. People just want to be in the cities. And again, Case and I are small town guys, and I think on the investment team, we're the only two that live in downtown Omaha.
That's true. Inverse correlation there.
Yeah. I know. How about that?
Okay. Climate change and resource scarcity.
Yep. So as population grows, power needs are stressed. We also need larger amounts of energy required from renewables. All the changes that corporations are making due to climate change, all of these are investable themes.
Finally, emerging global wealth.
Yep. So again, in this particular case, you could just say it's an argument for emerging markets, but it could be a little more nuanced than that. It's basically rapidly developing economies, particularly in Asia, are giving rise to a massive middle class of consumers. China, of course, is on track to become the world's largest economy, but it still has a limited representation in the global stock market. That is changing. Again, that is an investable theme. Again, CLS is partnered with BlackRock to really build a risk-managed portfolio of ETFs focused on these megatrends, these five megatrends. And obviously, these portfolios will be risk-budgeted. But also, we're doing a careful analysis of valuations, and we're really controlling exposure to potentially excessively overvalued areas, which is common when you kind of get a glamorous story to work with sometimes. And again, as I mentioned, some of these trends are new and they're less correlated to the overall traditional stock market, which I think is really cool that you get this diversification benefit.
All right. Well, before we close, I know you have some key terms that you'd like to go over. You can read more about this in your written commentary, but let's go through some of the really important ones.
I know this is super sexy here coming up. But you know what's important? Because I think good investor experiences require that it's about managing expectations. And it also means making sure people are using the right definitions for key terms. Yeah. And this stuff comes up all the time. So.
Okay, well, let's start with active versus passive.
So we talk about this a lot. So the simplest way to remember it is that an active, or I should say a passive strategy, means that you are just trying to match the returns and the risk of your benchmark before fees. Just trying to match it. Not trying to do anything heroic. You're just trying to match that performance. Active, meanwhile, thank you. Active means that you will have differences from that benchmark. And the reason why you would have differences is primarily because of expected returns and risk. And you think that you can add value above and beyond the benchmark over time.
Okay, so how about strategic versus tactical?
Yeah, so in some ways, some people like to use these same terms, but they really are different than active and passive. So strategic, the best investment definition of strategic is that you are managing to a target allocation. So you could be managing to a target asset allocation, or like a CLS portfolio, you're managing to a target risk allocation. Strategic can be active or it can be passive. Tactical, meanwhile, is a subset of active. And active management means you're just trying to be different than the benchmark, but you can do that through incremental changes in the portfolio, while tactical tends to represent more extreme strategy where you can dramatically and quickly change the asset allocation, the risk allocation of a portfolio. So again, so tactical is often used with active, and it is active, but active is much bigger than just simply just tactical strategies.
Finally, beta versus alpha.
Okay, beta versus alpha. So beta and alpha are really kind of technical terms within the industry, but they can be used in kind of broader, more generic terms. And beta basically just means market exposure. So if you want beta, you want the market. It's basically that simple. Beta is typically passive, but it can also be active, but it's usually constrained active, which means that the tilts in the portfolio are not too far away from the market. So really the primary driver of returns and risk is the market. Now, alpha is, you could say, is a kind of an interchangeable term with active, but it's actually, in this case, it's a little more granular, and it's very specific. It really kind of strips out the beta from the equation. And really, this is, again, it's kind of a subset of active, or you could say it really falls along alternative strategies. So really, the key term here is beta, and that just basically equates to the market.
Okay. And as I said, you can read more about this in Rusty's written commentary. Also, stay tuned for our quarterly market outlook to be released soon with more on what we expect to see in 2020. That's going to do it for the podcast. Hey, Case, thanks for being on the show today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And that'll do it. Rusty, take us out with your final thoughts.
Stay balanced, stay the course, and Happy New Year.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening to CLS's The Weighing Machine, and thank you for your time and trust in CLS Investments.